Hello, thanks for once again taking the time to download and listen to one of our podcasts. This is a football fans podcast and people behind CelticUnderground.net. Maybe the January transfer window, but that doesn't stop us from having loads and loads of podcasts. So we had Lawrence Donegan on from the By the Minute last couple of days ago, and today we've got Paul Quigley from Fans Against Criminalisation, and he's on to discuss the latest position in the potential repeal of the Offensive Behaviour at Football Act. Shortly we'll have someone who will give us a key insight into the transfer dealings at Celtic Park in a January transfer window. It will be a really interesting podcast, and it will be out beginning of February, hopefully. So that's one to look forward to, and there'll be other stuff in between. But before we get on to Paul's podcast, just a reminder that the latest Celtic Foundation thing is to walk on fire on Friday, 23rd of February. You can do a fire walk at Celtic Park, raising a minimum of £130 if you can, for Celtic being 130 years old. Go onto the Celtic FC Foundation website, or you can just Google, as I did to find the article to be able to tell you what date it is. Firewalk Celtic Foundation, and you'll find it. Anyway, next up is Paul. If you've been following anything to do with the Offensive Behaviour of Football Act, you might have seen him giving evidence to the Scottish Government Committee on the potential repeal and the consequences of the Act. My own position pretty clear. I know some people listening to this from previous discussions are in favour of the principle of the Act. My own position is pretty clear. You hear it in the podcast. If something's really so bad that you need legislation, I just don't understand why you would say it's only so bad if it happens during a football game. If I were you, I'd follow Celtic Research. He posts up brilliant statistics about how the issues in Scottish society that they're trying to tackle with the Act happen least at the football. So anyway, enough of me, far more detail here from Paul, and he tells you what to do. And if you go into the Celtic FC, Celtic Underground rather, website, you will get links on what to do next if this podcast motivates you. Are you gonna try to make this work? Or spread your dreams down in the dirt? So I'm joined now by Paul Quigley. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm fantastic, thanks very much. How are you?
I'm excellent, thanks. Now, you're on here and we're going to be talking, for people who don't know, you can explain in a minute, we're going to be talking about the Offensive Behaviour at Football Act and FAC and the work that you have been doing, and evidence to the Scottish Parliament, etc. But before any of that, we do have to check, you're on Celtic Underground, so we do have to check your credentials here. So what was your first Celtic game, and who was your first Celtic hero?
The first game I can ever remember going to was, I used to go with my uncle. My dad worked abroad a lot, so my uncle would take me to the games, and he would make me, you know, I'll take you to the game, just don't tell your mum that I'm out here drinking this bottle of Buckfast and stuff like that. And I think the first thing I'd done was run back and tell my mum, but the first game I remember was the Aberdeen game at home when George Cadet scored, and it was so loud that it knocked off the I don't know if it was a radio or the television at the time, but I remember it knocked off the BBC. That was my first ever memory, that Cadet goal. But my hero when I was growing up, even before then, was, and still is, I guess, to a large extent, was Paul McStay. Surely seen far name as him, but he was the same birthday as him as well, and he was always my hero growing up, and I don't think that'll ever change, to be honest.
So what was it about Paul McStay apart from having the same name?
Well, for me the thing about Paul McStay, it wasn't just his ability. Now you look at the time, especially in the kind of mid-90s, you know, the Celtic team was certainly not hitting the heights, you know, it was a very poor side. So in about the time that, you know, Bosman comes in as well, and, you know, players have all of a sudden seen that they can make moves abroad for nothing. You know, John Collins goes to Monaco. And the truth is, at his prime, you know, Paul McStay could have went anywhere. He could have left Celtic and went and played his football anywhere in Europe that he wanted to. But he chose to stay with Celtic through thick and thin, and for me, that makes him a hero worth remembering, I guess.
So we could talk about Celtic all night, but you're on here for a wider football matter, and that's to discuss the Offensive Behaviour in Football Act. People who listen to this podcast will know my position on this, yep. And we've had James Kelly on talking about the attempts to repeal the Act, and Jeanette from the Trust has been on, and people yep. who've been following it online may have seen you in some of the edited highlights or extended highlights online. So do you yep. want to just talk about what you've been doing and what's happening and where we are with it?
Right, okay. So obviously Fans Against Criminalisation were formed back in the summer of 2011 when the Offensive Behaviour Football Act was first mooted as a piece of emergency legislation at the time by Alex Salmond, following the so-called shame that happened earlier that year. At the time, the Fans Against Criminalisation was made up of the five main Celtic fan organisations, but it was never intended to be exclusive to Celtic fans, because we knew that, whilst I certainly think that much of it was targeted towards our support, the other fans would feel the brunt of it as well, and that's certainly how things have played out. Now, we've been campaigning ever since then since it was voted in anyway, for the repeal of the legislation, but also trying to help people who've been charged under it. Now, we've tried many things, I guess, over the course of the years, but at this point, I guess things properly changed in the summer of 2016 when the SNP lost their overall majority, which meant that there was therefore a majority of MSPs who actually supported the repeal of the legislation. In the run up to that election, we'd done a lot of campaigning, we'd been at Parliament, there was National Days of Action across Scotland, and that's really what forced the issue, and it meant that all of the opposition parties, the Green Party, the Labour Party, the Tories, the Lib Dems, all of them made manifesto pledges to repeal the legislation. So ever since that election, that's what we've all kind of been collectively working on, even if there'll certainly be members of FAC that we certainly wouldn't hold a lot of common ground with some of the people we're working with, but we agree on this much, and we're obviously working towards a repeal. Now, in terms of the repeal process, I can go into that in a bit of detail just now if you want.
Yeah, that'd be good. That, yeah, because obviously lots of us, we maybe have some people listening to this will be in favour of it, some people will be neutral, mm-hmm. and some people will be against it. A lot of the people yeah. who are maybe neutral or against it and have and even for it, they'll have a passing interest for a lot of people. Yeah. And they'll just be aware that there's been talk of it being repealed, but it's not okay. been repealed, so it'd be useful.
Yeah. Okay, so whenever an act's passed through the Scottish Parliament, there's three stages to that. Now, we're just approaching the end of stage one for the repeal bill. Now, stage one is by far and away the longest kind of part of that process, if you will. It would start with a consultation. Now, James Kelly lodged his consultation. This gave people across Scotland the opportunity to submit the evidence of their experiences of the Act and their opinions and thoughts and things like that. And a number of responses for that, I think it was over 3,500, was the biggest response of its kind for that kind of consultation in the Scottish Parliament website. And over 72% of those who responded to it were strongly in favour of repealing the Act. So that's really what gave us the foundation, I guess, to kind of build for the repeal from that point and move it into the parliamentary chamber. So what happens then is, because it's a justice issue, it gets put to the Justice Committee. What they then sought to do was gather evidence of their own. They requested more written submissions, which they got from, they would get from individuals, but at that point there was a real focus on the kind of quality of the submissions rather than the quantity. So you've seen lots of submissions from the likes of Liberty, the Law Society, BMIS, the Black and Ethnic Minority Institute of Scotland, groups like that who strongly opposed the Offensive Behaviour Act. And then what the Parliament done was, or the Justice Committee done was, they requested to gather oral evidence from, you know, various experts and interested parties, and that included Fans Against Criminalisation herself. Myself and Jeanette Finlay went along in October, I believe it was, and since then they've held evidence gathering sessions. They held them almost every week or two, right up until December. So they've finished now in terms of the kind of investigation, as it were, in terms of gathering as much evidence as you can as a parliamentary body, and now what they'll do is they'll make a report and a recommendation within that report. Then that's due shortly, and that'll be published for people to see on the Justice Committee website. But Fans Against Criminalisation will also circulate that quite widely when it comes out. What the good thing is that we're nearly at the end of stage one. Now, what has to happen at the end of stage one is the full of Parliament votes on the principles of the bill. And that has to happen by the 26th of January. So that's why Fans Against Criminalisation today started our email campaign to try and put the pressure on, so to speak, because as it works out, we only have the margin of victory, the distance between votes in our favour and votes against us, it's down to 2 votes. So what we have to do is try and make sure that politicians across the country know that we are watching them and that we expect them to vote in favour of repeal after following the damage that this Act has done across Scotland. Once that vote's been had, it'll move to stage two, which is actually quite quick. That'll be the amendment stage. Mm-hmm. But given this is a repeal bill and not new legislation, it's not really expected that that part of the process will be particularly long. So in reality, all we'll have to kind of go over again is some of the issues with the live cases and things like that. But everything else is kind of settled. That should really only take, we would hope, 1 meeting of the Justice Committee. And then from that point, it goes to stage three, which is a full debate in the parliamentary chamber. And then it goes to the final vote, the second and final vote at the end of stage three. And once we've, if we win that, then the Act will be repealed. All we have to do is wait a few weeks for the Royal assent for the Queen to sign it, and then it's gone. But I guess I think the thing that we would like to stress more than anything is that it's not quite done yet. You know, we've had 7 years of this campaign, 6 years of the Act in place, and throughout that time the Celtic support have been absolutely incredible. You know, they've supported Fans Against Criminalisation throughout, you know, be it by helping with the email campaigns, by showing up at demonstrations, by supporting the legal fund for people who've been charged, and I think that given the size of what we as a support have nearly achieved here in terms of, you know, beating down government legislation, this hasn't ever happened before. This will be the first time in the history of the Scottish Parliament that the Scottish Parliament has repealed legislation that itself has enacted. It's never happened before, but our support has stood up to the government on this, and with just a few months left, I think we owe it to ourselves, I think we owe it to everyone who's worked over the years, the effort, the support has put in, and I think we owe it to people whose lives have been ruined, unfortunately, as have been caught up in this, to make sure that we see out the last few months, and that does include doing things like the email campaign. You know, it takes, I think it's 30 seconds, and it sends off, you know, emails to both your constituency MSP and your list MSPs, to make sure that they know that we are watching, and hopefully we'll get it by the first vote, and certainly as the pace gathers in February, March, possibly April, you know, Fans Against Criminalisation will be you know, in kind of full frontal mode. At that point, we'll be calling demonstration, I would suspect, we'll be calling different actions, and we will be looking for the support to back us for these final few months to help us get it over the line.
So why do you think that every party other than the SNP is in favour of the repeal of this? Is it some of them are just political opportunism, or do you think there's a real passion amongst the opposition parties that this is just bad law?
I think that it's just bad law. I don't think that it's ideology has anything to do with it. I think if you introduce a piece of legislation that unites Celtic fans and Rangers fans, that unites the Tories and the Green Party, then it's not down to ideology, it's not down to politics. Everyone who has any kind of credible voice on this is against it. The Law Society said that it's bad law. The BEMIS, Black and Ethnic Minorities Institute, says that it targets ethnic minorities. When you look at other groups, not the Law Society, Liberty, the biggest civil rights group in the UK, have said that it endangers civil liberties, and now the Scottish Human Rights Convention have said that it might be incompatible with the Human Rights Act. It's not about playing politics. The only ones who are playing politics on this are the SNP, because they were told all of this. Mm-hmm. 2011, none of this is new. You know what I mean? We've not come up with some new argument in the last year that's changed minds or changed the state of play in any way. This was all told to them. You can go back, you can go through YouTube and watch the evidence gathering sessions in 2011. You can go on to the Parliament website and see the submissions that were put in then by groups like the Celtic Trust, and they were warned that this was going to happen.
So do you think, without getting into the politics of it, do you think this is one of the, as a wee aside, one of the downsides of the Scottish Parliament not having a revising chamber? Much as most people listening to this would think that the House of Lords should be an elected chamber.
Yeah,
the principle of parliamentary law goes to the Lords for the Lords to review it, fine tune it, get rid of the bad bits, to put it back. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm certainly not going to come on your show and advocate the House of Lords by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think there's an issue of balance. I do think there's an issue of scrutiny at the Scottish Parliament that's missing. One example I would use, if you don't mind looking into it, was there was a few kind of equalities groups who supported the legislation and were against the repeal, put in evidence to the Justice Committee as such. Now, the Scottish Women's Convention, who are funded by the Scottish Government, were one of the groups that done that. Now, I don't know if you followed what happened with that, but they put in what I can only describe as a very dangerous submission, which wasn't really based on anything. It seemed to insinuate that somehow women were more fragile and more likely to be offended by shouting at a football match, which is as offensive as I can possibly imagine to the many women that I go to football matches with. And there were also some really insidious suggestions that football matches were somehow dens of kind of almost sexual assault at some points, and in a way that I felt was really rooted in anti-working class prejudice. But what happened was they had made this written submission, so a lot of women, understandably, who'd read it were really insulted by it and decided to contact them to say, no, this isn't actually experience of defensive behaviour act at all. It doesn't, none of those things actually are really an issue at football, certainly an issue at football, and the offensive behaviour act wouldn't tackle any of that. So I don't know. So there was 40 emails sent to the Scottish Women's Convention. Now, they were invited to give oral evidence at the Scottish Parliament, a woman called Debbie Figgers. And we thought it was a bit odd, frankly, that they said that they'd held consultations on the Act, and that's where they'd got this evidence. We thought it was slightly odd that, Glasgow's not a big place, and for a women's group to have consultations on the Act when we follow everything on it, and for us to not know about it, seemed a bit strange. But Debbie Figgers, when questioned on it in the Scottish Parliament, she said that they held two consultations recently on the repeal of the Act, one with 60 women, one with 20 women, I think it was. I can't quite remember what the numbers were she gave, but anyway, she said that they held two consultations on it. And that soon unravelled, and it turned out to be a lie, to which they admitted what they'd actually done was taking the quotes from a piece of research that was actually done in 2012. And this would only happen after we found digging it. Now, the point I'm getting at is here is that Debbie Figgers of the Scottish Women's Convention didn't get up in the morning and decide, I'm going to go and lie to the Justice Committee to help the Scottish Government off the loan back.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't happen. But what you see is that these groups, this is a group who are funded by the Scottish Government, who then go to bat for the Scottish Government on an issue which shouldn't really be that relevant to them without You know, they've done that, but they've also ignored, this is meant to be an advocacy group for women, and they ignored the emails of 40 intelligent, passionate, articulate women who contacted them because it didn't, you know, align with.
It didn't fit with what they wanted to be said.
Correct. So my worry is that, you know, we tried to get this. The Common Space ran a piece on it. But by and large, you know, all we kind of went under the carpet, so to speak, and nothing came of it. Now, I think there's real issues there about parliamentary democracy, that if there's meant to be scrutiny, and, you know, you have groups like this who are funded by the Scottish Government, who are quite simply going to bat for the Scottish Government, no matter what, then it becomes that kind of echo chamber that creates bad legislation. And that's been this act from the very get-go. And I think that this act has really helped to bring a lot of those issues to the fore. You know, some of the blurred lines that have appeared between the government and the judiciary, some of the ways that the police have been directed in some cases. And I'd be here all night talking about it, but I do think there are very real issues about the way that the Scottish Government have been held to account, especially when they had the absolute majority. But we can all be thankful that that's no longer the case.
Yeah, I mean, certainly from my position as an outsider looking in, it looks like they've enacted rushed legislation. Once it's enacted, everybody's telling them it's wrong, but there's no obvious route to then say, hands up, this was a mistake, let's revise it and put it back. They've actually gone the opposite way of then try to enforce the police to enforce it the way they want it.
What I struggle with is, you know, I seen it when it came in, and you could see the arrogance of guys like Alex Hammond, guys like Kenny McCaskill, Stephen House. You know, they exuded it. You know, they really did think at that point, you know, that they could do whatever they wanted. You know, that the SNP, particularly in Scotland, were the only game in town. They were going to romp election after election. Police Scotland was obviously about to be amalgamated. That gave House all the power he wanted. And these guys just kind of rode roughshod over everyone. But what I find interesting is that most of the people who brought this in are gone. Mm-hmm. You know, Alex Salmond isn't First Minister anymore. Kenny McCaskill was shunted basically as soon as Nicola Sturgeon got the job. House resigned in disgrace, and it looks like several of his colleagues might have to follow suit. And Mulholland, Frank Mulholland, is no longer the Lord Advocate. So there was plenty of scope, I think, for Nicola Sturgeon to come in and say, look, we've made a bit of a hash of this here. We need to put our hands up. And I think people would respect that of politicians, because no politicians ever do that. They just come out and put their hands up and admit, look, we've got this wrong. And people would eat that up. And you can't tell me that there's been a single person who's voted for the SNP because they so strongly support the Offensive Behaviour Act, but they have lost votes over it. They absolutely have lost votes over it. So for me, the one thing that I often think about is, what have they had to gain by sticking by this? And you can only really conclude, or the only thing I can really conclude, is that it's just stubbornness. It's just an saving face.
I actually think if they revisited it or taken more time in the first place, it would have been a lot more difficult to be at the point that you're at just now.
That's one of the things that they say now, and you've got to laugh at it when you watch, you know, the Justice Committee, and some of them are saying, well, why don't you just talk to the government instead of going for outright repeal? And you know, you're thinking, because we were banging in the government's door for, you know, 5 years, and nobody wanted to speak to us. Nobody was willing to look at what was going wrong. They refused to have an early review of the Act, and then the review that they had to have legally was a washout. You know, they had opportunities to go back over this. They had the chance to review this and see where it was going wrong and sit down. And to be honest, whilst they had an absolute majority, you know, there was probably room to talk on certain parts of it. You know, obviously, Section 120E of the Act, in terms of the Offensive Behaviour Clause, was what was extremely problematic. But they refused to engage, they refused to sit down, they refused to talk. So it's all this chatter now about, oh, why don't we work together, it's just nonsense. It's just utter nonsense. And obviously now the tables have turned a little bit, unfortunately. We're going to chance to push for the field.
So obviously there will be people listening to this, and there are certainly maybe football fans who will say, but do you know what, I want to take my kids to football and I don't want to hear songs about Irish republicanism or Northern Irish unionism or any of that nonsense. I'm actually quite thankful that there's a piece of legislation that's aimed at trying to stop people talking about that stuff in the football, because it's going to have to do with football.
Well, I mean, there's a difference, isn't there, between wanting Peter, thinking that people shouldn't sing it, and thinking that people should be criminalised for singing it. And I think that's the difference. People are entitled to their opinions about politics and sport, about what should be sung on the terraces. You know, we support legislation that already existed that criminalised, you know, racist, sectarian, homophobic, sexist chanting, that kind of thing. But to outlaw, you know, offensiveness is so subjective. What you find offensive, I might not, and vice versa. It creates too much of a broadening blurring of what is legally allowed, and the result of that, it's been played out, you know, in terms of people who've been arrested and people who've been dragged through the courts. And you know, I can sit here and I can list the things that people have been arrested for, and I don't think that in a modern democracy singing some of these songs, as long as they're not racist, sectarian, overtly hateful, I don't think that should be a criminal offence.
Well, let me, again, people who listen to this will know my position, but let me give you a devil's advocate position. Do you know, one of my most embarrassing days as a Celtic supporter was sitting next to the girlfriend of Adam Virgo.
Right.
And she's from Brighton. Mm-hmm. And we were at Fir Park, and our support sang IRA songs from the kick-off to the final whistle. And obviously, being from Brighton, she turned to me and said, why were they singing those songs every single game, every single minute of the game? And I didn't really have an answer to say anything to her. And again, there'll be people listening to this saying, What place have they got? And do you know what? You know that those songs are illegal, so why you bother singing them?
Well, I mean, under the legislation, the bottom line is that so many things could be construed as illegal. That's one of the issues that it creates. It creates a confusion and more. But in regards to Republican songs, as I say, it's not about whether you support them or not, whether you personally would go to an away match and sing them for 1 minute or 90. It's about whether or not people should be criminalised, thrown in jail, dragged through the courts, lose their job, have their names dragged through the papers, sometimes with a picture, sometimes with an address, because they sing a song which expresses a political view that you don't agree with. That's what it comes down to, in my opinion.
Aye, but again, I might not agree that the speed limit, you know, I'm just putting it the opposite way. Yeah. I might not agree that the speed limit should be 70 on the motorway. I think modern cars, compared to the speed limit was set at 70 years ago. Modern cars, it should be 100. So I should be allowed to drive at 100 because the law's wrong.
No, I don't think that you can compare, you know, what is meant to be a safety feature, you know, in terms of that kind of legislation. It's about safety, it's about people keeping people safe, and legislation which is about constricting people's right to express themselves and constricting people's thought. I think that's two entirely different things. What I would say is that, as I say, under this legislation, people have been arrested for one, I don't know if I should swear here on it, but just to exemplify what I'm talking about, you know, there was one Hamilton fan who was arrested and spent, I think it was 4 or 5 days in Greenock prison, because he was arrested at a Friday night game. The local police station was full, it was a bank holiday. He was taken, or two of them actually were taken to Greenock prison for singing "Well, Well, Fuck Your Will." Now, that's what happens when you start constricting speech. If you decide that anyone who sings anything which might be considered as offensive should be arrested, you open it up to people being arrested for these kind of menial things. That's what's been happening. And the only way that a democratic society works is if people, whether you agree with them or not, are free to express views so long as they're not overtly hateful.
Well, then part of the issue which I've noticed happening in the last 2 years, I don't know whether as momentum has come around the repeal of the Act, this has happened more or not. The blurring of the lines as what is sectarian in Scotland seems to have come into place.
Well, I mean, I think that's been an issue for...
In terms of reporting?
A lot longer than the offence. I think in terms of, you know, even before the Act came in, you know, there's the term sectarianism doesn't have any legal character in Scottish law. I actually thought it was really interesting listening to, I think it was Anthony Hogan, his name was, who was the representative of the Catholic Church, who attended one of the Justice Committee hearing sessions, and what he spoke about was that what we should really be looking to do is, rather than referring to acts as being sectarian, we should call them, you know, about what they specifically are. So if it's anti-Catholic, call it anti-Catholic. If it's anti-Protestant, call it anti-Protestant or anti-Semitic or whatever it might be. And that way we create a more narrow definition, a more specific definition, sorry, of what it is we mean by these terms of hate crimes. But by simply bungling, you know, any expressions of Irish identity or British identity as being sectarian is to miss the point entirely. And, you know, that's what's been happening, unfortunately. And Scotland, I do think you're right, I think Scotland has to have a mature discussion about sectarianism, about what that means and about how we tackle it. But this Act doesn't enable that. This Act actually gets in the way of it.
Well, it gets back to the point I often make, and I always think you've got to be careful because it's dead easy to fall into the neutral person who's the real person you need to win over in this. It's like, you know, anything to, you know, to win an election, it's the neutral people you need to win over. The people on either extreme will vote either way. And this, as you said, there's only two votes in it. So it's the neutral person who needs to get their weight behind, or the person who's swithering, that will really be the person who pushes this over the edge, not the people like you who've been proactive about it.
No, I slightly disagree there, just because we're at the point of campaign now that, you know, we've been at this since the summer of 2011. You know, we're coming up on 7 years of this. I think if anyone is still on the sideline, I'm not convinced they're going to be brought over. What we need, in my opinion, is to infuse our support base, which is primarily the Celtic support, but also, you know, small factions of active fan bases around the country to get active, to make sure that they're the ones pushing.
Aye, sorry, when I was saying the neutral person, what I was really meaning is the neutral person in terms of their activity. The you know, people will expect you to turn up and make a point about this. What might be the pushing point is the person who has always been vehemently against it, but didn't go in the consultation, didn't do anything.
For me, you know, I understand that there's people, you know, view sectarianism as a social scourge in Scotland, and I get all of that. You know, we're not campaigning as pro-sectarian campaigners or pro-hate campaigners, but in terms of this legislation, I think if almost any reasonable, rational person sat down and read what was in this Act and seen what had gone on, I think you could only conclude that this Act has been a disaster from start to finish. Laws should apply universally. You shouldn't have a law which discriminates against one specific sector of society. And secondly, you shouldn't have a law which criminalises something as subjective as offensiveness, because as soon as you do that, almost everything is fair game. It gives the police carte blanche to arrest people for almost anything. And that's what's been happening. That's been the cost of it. And that's what will continue unless we get this repealed.
And that's one of my big issues about it. See, if communication and behaviour is so offensive that people should be arrested for it, I don't think you shouldn't. It's bonkers to me that you have a situation where, but it's only arrestable if they're football fans. See, if they don't like football but they behave in exactly the same way, we can't arrest them. I mean, that's just bonkers.
But that's exactly what I mean. You know, if you sit down and take the law to its fullest extent, it's madness. It's utterly crazy. I mean, one of the things that we were maybe a wee bit cheeky with it, but Rosanna Cunningham, I'm sure it was her, I'm 95% sure of her, I'm maybe not check, but she held a press conference of some sort. I was holding some type of interview in a pub. I think it was around about 2012-2013, and in the background there was a Champions League game on one of the tellies, and in her interview she made a kind of derogatory remark about conservative MSPs, using language that could be construed as offensive, and she was reported to the police by a FAC supporter, I believe, and the police's response was, unfortunately we can't arrest her, well, not unfortunately, but we can't take any action on this because it's a Champions League game, but had it been a Scottish football match on that telly we would have arrested her.
I mean, that's just utterly,
it's mad, it's how can legislation be defined in such a clumsy way? It's utterly mad. And when you really get down to the nitty gritty of it, it's lunacy, you know, to have, you know, people, you know, one of the analogies that often given, you know, two groups of guys going in a train, and one's going to a rugby match and one's going to a football match, and there's songs that they can sing that the others can't. It's mad. That's why, you know, you have to have comprehensive, universal hate crime legislation which deals with hateful behaviour, but whilst also protecting people's rights to freedom of speech. But to single out one group in society in the way that this act has, is just wrong. I just can't imagine any other group in society being singled out in this way. You know, I don't know if there was one video that we put up in Fact Twitter maybe 2-3 years ago. It was like a small group of relatively young football fans, but they're a bit silent, you know, not making a noise.
Mm-hmm.
And the accompanying police officer, can we laugh and think, that's what it was actually. And the accompanying police officer walks down the carriage to announce to the rest of the train, if any of these fans are abusive or offensive to you, I want you to get in touch with us immediately. So he immediately marks them out as, you know, wrongdoers, as potential criminals, as potential offenders. And, you know, if that video was to go up and it was to be a group of young Asian guys and the police were walking down the same point, pointing at them, saying, if they do anything, you come let me know, there would be uproar, and rightly so. But with football fans, it's almost accepted that you'll be viewed as a criminal just off the bat in some circumstances. And that's the culture that this act has created. And it boils down, in my opinion, to, you know, that there is, you know, society does view football fans, you know, and certainly some parts of society view football fans as thugs and bigots and louts and wife beaters and drunk, whatever else. And this kind of prejudice is what is underpinned this legislation, what's allowed it to come to the fore.
But it is that thing of the whole narrative of Scotland's the greatest free country in the world narrative. You can't be the greatest free country in the world if you have a sectarian problem, because you're supposed to be this perfect country. So it does allow them to then package it up and say, actually, it's not Scotland's fault. It's actually just those dirty down market football fans. It's their fault.
And what it allows them to do is it allows them to package sectarianism as a class issue, when, you know, sectarianism has been rife throughout various social, you know, all social classes since before, you know, Irish immigrants even got off the boat in Scotland. And the other thing that allows them to do is by packaging it in, I hate to use the phrase, but, you know, the kind of old thumb, it allows them to paint it as, you know, two sides of the same coin. And it's, you know, it's an inaccurate reflection of the kind of social circumstances in Scotland, in my opinion. I mean, one of the things I always remember, when we played, when the kind of New Rangers came up and we played them in the, it was the semi-final when we beat them 2-0 and Chris Collins and Griffiths scored at Hampden. You know, the press building up to that, because there hadn't been a fixture like that in years, the press was just mental. It was, you know, you couldn't pick up the papers without seeing, you know, all this stuff. You know, police were, I think we read more about the police's tactics for the game than we did about Ronnie Dyla's, you know what I mean? It was just constant stuff, you know, footage of the police going to warn the players, you know, stuff about how they were going to police it, all the potential flashpoints, I think, one newspaper had. And then, you know, the game came and went without any disorder at all. But the front page of the Sun on the next day was Cops 1, Job 0, as if to suggest that the football fans have only been able to behave because of the police, because we're all yobs. That's how we're all viewed, as a as a starting point, even when a game like that that he's tried to build up has resulted in no disorder of note. And I think that's what underpins a lot of the, you know, that's what underpins the prejudice, I guess. It's the prejudice that underpins.
Yeah, and it's as much to do with the reporting of it.
Yeah.
As it much to do with the politicians. I mean, to some extent, the politicians and the famous shame game thing. And you were probably at that game. I was at that game. The only thing that I was aware of at that game was what's his face? The guy who spat on when he played for Liverpool.
Juff.
The only thing I remember was Juff being held back by the police trying to get to the Rangers fans to throw his shirt.
Aye, because he tried to get in even after he got sent off, didn't he?
Yeah.
Like, I think he did. That's the only thing I was aware of at the game.
It wasn't until I got home.
There were more Rangers players booked that night than Celtic fans arrested, I'm sure. And most of the Celtic fans arrested for smoking in the toilet.
I mean, the only people who are aware that there was any sort of controversy were the people watching the telly often.
Yeah.
I remember joking with someone that it should have been the offensive behaviour by people watching football games on the telly act. Because
there's no fans
at the game were impacted by it. And then an example of the reporting. See if you go on the BBC News app, so you know how you can get your chunks of what you want, and so I've got news for Glasgow in the West. The main story for Glasgow in the West on the 30th of December, and it was still in the top four stories by the 2nd of January, 11 arrested at Old Firm game. Right? There was 60,000 people there.
I know.
With a piece of legislation that makes it easier to arrest people, and there was 11 arrested. And then I looked up, and in Edinburgh's Hogmanay celebrations, I was trying to find, nowhere did I find how many were arrested. There was 12 people arrested at 75,000 people. Because of course you're going to get some petty crime going on.
Large gathers of people would have been on the drink. And I mean, Stuart Regan made a very good point at the Justice Committee. Maybe a bit unlike him in some respects. He made a very good point about, you know, the comparison with Tina Park. You know, when he rhymed off the huge list of offences that took part at Tina Park between, I think it was in a 9-year span. And, you know, at no point was anyone worried about the assaults or the sexual assaults or the drug offences or the kidnapping or the attempted murders. You know, the huge list of criminal offences, yet there was no, you know, call for emergency legislation at that point. I remember after that shame game, one of my mates had a group of pals in Italy, and they were texting him, worried, like, is everyone okay? Did anything happen? Because they'd seen it in the news in Italy and thought that there was just this crazy amount of disorder in Glasgow, and there was absolutely nothing. I mean, if you remember that season, I think we played them 7 times.
Yeah.
So, like, I remember thinking that the game was, in terms of the fans, the atmosphere was a bit tame. We're getting a bit sick of the side, you know. But I think it bred a bit of discontent between the players. I think they were all getting, you know, really, you know, I think that, you know, like, Juth and Bagheera and, you know, like, Sir Brown and Wesley and stuff on our side, you know, they were certainly getting each other's faces, and that familiarity was certainly breeding contempt. But with the fans, I think they're looking a bit bored of it, to be honest. And you know, that game really, on the grander scheme of things, wasn't a major flashpoint. It wasn't major scenes of disorder, certainly caused by the fans anyway. But obviously, you know, they called the joint action group from that, and then the following few months were certainly very, you know, tumultuous, dark time in Scotland for the Irish diaspora, and the way that certain figures were targeted, and it was vile. But the bottom line is that, you know, sending a nail bomb, you know, sending a bullet through the post or attacking a manager on the pitch side at Tynecastle was all criminal offences then, and they're criminal offences now, and the offensive behaviour that doesn't change any of it.
And I think that's the key. See, the main, right, there's two parts to it. See, the main bits of behaviour that people wouldn't want, people being assaulted, racist behaviour, all of that, behaviour that's likely to cause trouble, all of that was illegal before the act.
Yeah, it was. What it was in the aftermath of that game, what happened was, You know, there was obviously the flashpoints that the media jumped on. Jack McConnell then starts giving the SNP, you know, a bit of grief for their, you know, perceived lack of activity on sectarianism, because he had obviously made it quite a focal point of his premiership. And, you know, Salmon has kind of took the bait in a way. He arranged this joint action group, him and Stephen House. And I think House probably seen, you know, he knew that the forces were about to be amalgamated. He seen an opportunity to prove his loyalty to his political masters, and he seen an opportunity to increase his public persona and his profile. And he grabbed it, and it obviously paid dividends for him, because he eventually did... you know, going to take the kind of top role there before it all went a bit pear-shaped for them. But I do think it was as simple as, you know, certainly for Salmon, certainly for the SNP, I think they thought it was just going to be a cheap political win. I don't think that there was a massive amount of thought. I mean, you can read it. I mean, I think the legislation speaks for itself. I don't think there was a massive amount of thought put in to what it was they were doing, to what the legislation would criminalise, what the impact would be, and I think that they thought it would be a cheap political win to get some headlines at the time. You know, it wasn't an attempt to deal with, you know, a deep-rooted societal issue. It was just a bit political point scoring, and they thought that it would hopefully, you know, be a protest for a bit, but it'd eventually go away, and that hasn't happened, and it's haunted them ever since.
So what's the next steps? Where are we? What can people do to get involved?
Well, as of the time of recording, I believe the Celtic Trust website is unfortunately down at the moment, but I am assured by your technical team that it will hopefully be back up and running. So even by the time this airs, I'm hoping that the Trust website will be back up and running. But what I would urge people to do is, if you're a supporter, go on and take part in the email campaign. All you need to do, you input your postcode, and then it'll bring up your constituency MSP, along with, you know, the various list MSPs, and it'll send off a kind of standard email with your name, asking them to support the repeal of the legislation. Now, it can't really be overstated, you know, the impact this is. You know, we've met with you know, all the opposition parties, and the SNP, I guess, the points as well. But one of the things they'll say is that, you know, if you come in on a Monday morning and you've got, you know, 60 emails in all asking the one thing, you know, it's a nightmare, and it does put pressure on them. They do realise that this is an issue that isn't going to just go away. So what we need is for those who support us to just take the time, take the 30 seconds to go and put pressure on those people who have to go and vote within the next couple of weeks. If, however, I understand that, you know, I'm maybe not preaching to the converted completely here, so I understand that there'll be people who are maybe in the stance and maybe don't feel as passionate about it as myself and other campaigners. What I would urge them to do is to, if they want to learn a wee bit more, if they want to see how this came about, see the impact that it's had, and then maybe listen to some of the expert opinions from people, you know, academic backgrounds, legal backgrounds, civil rights campaigners, things like that. If they want to hear from them, if they want to see what's happened, go and watch the short film that Fans Against Criminalisation made. It's about 55 minutes long, but I think it's worth a watch, and hopefully that will help sway people slightly as well, but I guess we'll see.
And how far away are we, if things go well, from this legislation being repealed?
I'm always, this is a question I get asked on almost a daily basis at this point by friends and everything else. I'm a bit wary about giving a specific timeline, but I do think we're very close. I would hope that, you know, stage one has to be done by this month. So I would hope that, you know, we'll maybe move into stage two, hopefully about February-ish. And I would hope to have it done by hopefully March, April, I would think. Obviously, you know, if this campaign's taught me anything, it's that, you know, things don't always necessarily go to plan. There's obviously a bit of bureaucracy there. Things could change. But I genuinely think that we'll in course, hopefully, for a March, April repeal. But as I say, you know, it's not all done yet. We can't all rest on our laurels, and we need to try and make sure that enough pressure is put on the MSPs who have to vote to get this over the line.
And there's only two votes in it, so a broken leg and a bout of gastroenteritis could scupper everything, so it's really tight.
Yep. Yeah, it really is. It's you know, as I say, for us to have got to this point, you know, to have, you know, some of the things that fans have endured, some of the things that have happened over these 6 years, for us to persevere. And I don't mean the campaign, I mean the full support and football supporters across Scotland as well. For us to persevere with this campaign and get it to this point, it would be such a shame if it fell short at this point, just because, you know, we didn't do enough in the final stages. So, you know, it's kind of, the light is at the end of the tunnel, is what I'm saying. And we're just asking people for one last push.
Okay. So yeah, is it going to be? Are they going to win it? Is it going to be won on penalties? Is it going to go extra time? Is
it? I don't know. I think I'll be losing my hair come the time of these two votes. It'll be pretty nerve-wracking stuff. But listen, I mean, I do think that we will repeal it. You know, I do think we'll win. And I'm confident, but there's obviously small things that are outside of our control. You know, I hope, but. You know, everybody needs to stay fit and healthy and make sure they're there for the votes. But as I say, we just need to keep the pressure up, and then hopefully we can book the party bus to pick us all up from Parliament on the day of the vote.
Okay, well, with that, I will say, Paul, thanks very much.
Excellent. Thanks very much for having us on. I really massively appreciate it. And thanks to everyone as well who took the time to watch the video. And a massive, massive thanks to everyone who took time to take part in the email campaign.
You look good out there, baby. I was born by the river.
I hope you found that illuminating and enlightening. And if you want to do something about it, if you go to CelticTrust.net, onto their website, front page, email your MSP today, Axe the Act. It is a really simple process and I'll talk you through. So go to CelticTrust.net. You can either click on email your MSP today, Axe the Act, and it will tell you what to do. Or you can just go straight to the right and I'll talk you through it as I'm doing it right now. Contact your MSP. There's a description about contacting your MSP, instructions. Go down to the bottom of the page, type in your postcode, blah, 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 press find my MSP, and there you go, it gives me my constituency MSP and my list MSPs, and then I can click on them and email them. Straightforward, really straightforward, and they even have an email template, dear MSP's name, and you can copy and paste that in. Really, really straightforward. If you're at all motivated by the principle of a piece of legislation that says, see all society's problems, they're all your fault because you're a dirty down market football fan, and you don't think that quite right, then I would urge you to do this and make sure, as you heard Paul say, it's only two votes in it. Only needs one guy to fall and break his leg, one woman to have an appendix operation or whatever, and there's a problem. Enough of me ranting on. This is me, Harry Brady. That was him, Paul Quiddly, of France Against Criminalisation.
Let me see you wave your hand. I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes it will. But I've gotta take my say this, look. Then I go to my brother. Yes, sir. And I tell him, I said, brother, help me, please. But he winds up knocking me. He knocks me back down on my the time that I thought.
Everybody take your hand back and forth like this. Everybody. You sitting in the first balcony too. Heavenly please. All over the auditorium tonight. All over the auditorium. Hallelujah.